We have the pleasure of Judge Giulio from the Northern District of Indiana sitting with us this morning. And with that, we'll take the first case, Bernstein v. Banker.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Norman Bernstein. Opening just one small point, Mr. Emhart and I decided amongst ourselves in preparation that we'd like to split the time slightly differently than on your cards. I'll take 10 minutes. Mr. Emhart will take 5 in our opening argument. We've notified the clerk. This is an appeal from dismissal of the plaintiff's CERCLA and state law claims on statute of limitations grounds. The district court dismissed the action as to the CERCLA claims under Section 113G3 of CERCLA. Appellant's contention is that the statute was never triggered, and therefore the action was not barred by the statute. The statute has 3 triggers. They are a judgment, the entry of administrative orders under the de minimis provisions of CERCLA, or a cash reimbursement to the government provisions, and the judicially approved settlement. None of those were applicable to the claims that we assert. Therefore, the statute was not triggered.
Counsel, why do you argue that the de minimis settlement trigger does not apply here?
Because the district court found, Your Honor, that the settlement that was entered into had 2 very distinct parts. One was the part pertaining to the non-de minimis parties, called non-premium respondents, which required them to do the cleanup work at the site, fund the trust, and sign the trust agreement and commit themselves to funding the cleanup. The de minimis parties cashed out. They did not sign the trust and were not obligated to make any payments beyond their cash-out payments. So there were 2 distinct parts. That's what the district court correctly found as fact, and I believe that's what the consent order says. It's not disputed that this is the initial action for recovery of costs, and it is not disputed that this is a removal action, not a remedial action. And so we believe that the applicable statute of limitations is Section 113G2 of the CERCLA statute, and that statute has not run. It's not disputed that the cleanup is ongoing and it's not complete, and the statute trigger for the statute of limitations under 113G2 is the completion of the removal action.
So I want to talk to you about the terms voluntary and compelled. Where does the voluntary versus compelled distinction come from with respect to Section 107 versus 113, and why doesn't it have relevance here?
I believe it does have relevance, Your Honor. The Atlantic Research case had 2 branches to it. It said you could bring a 107 action if, A, you are suing for your own response costs, not monies you paid to someone else for their response costs, and there's also a suggestion, I think because of the facts of that case, that the action has to be voluntary as opposed to being the subject, footnote 6 to Atlantic Research, of a lawsuit and a consent decree. There was no lawsuit. There was no consent decree. We were not sued. The underlying point here is that the bankers and their insurance carrier don't want to pay anything. They want a free ride. And we're the ones that are cleaning up the mess that they made, and they're here trying to prevent themselves from having to pay anything towards the cleanup. That does not encourage settlement in Superfund cases, and it's not fair. Now, as far as the voluntary part is concerned, there's additional case law on that. There is the AG case in the Third Circuit. The AG case, which the defendants rely on to some extent, actually says that companies that were sued in that case could not bring a 107 action because they entered into consent decree, they were sued, and therefore it was not voluntary. But companies that were not sued and voluntarily paid money to clean up the site could bring a 107 action. That's precisely the distinction we're making. Now, in our case, the consent orders were entered into voluntarily, that's what they say, There was no lawsuit. The government did not have to sue the parties that entered into it. They entered into that voluntarily. In effect, it was a contract with the administrative agency to do a cleanup. And so we believe we satisfy all of the criteria to bring a direct action to 107. But our point also is that, in a sense, it may not matter. Because whether you characterize this as a 107 action or a 113 action, the basic fact is the statute of limitations that the lower court relied on was not triggered. And so under either case, the action is timely. Now, I'd like to make just a few more points. The bankrupt's effort to get around the statute of limitation has two parts. First, they attempt to conflate the two provisions of the consent order and try to say that this is somehow a de minimis settlement. Well, I'm sorry, we do not represent de minimis parties. De minimis parties have no interest in this lawsuit. Our claims are not based on claims of the de minimis parties. The second thing they tried to do is to say that somehow allowing this case to proceed as a 107 case would somehow vitiate the contribution protections of the de minimis parties. And that issue was addressed squarely in Atlantic Research. The government at that case tried to argue the same thing. Atlantic Research was a case which the Justice Department did not succeed in. And Atlantic Research squarely held that that argument is not tenable. Court addressed it on my copy. It's page 9 of the Westlaw version. Finally, permitting plaintiffs to seek recovery under 107A will not eviscerate the settlement bar set forth in 113F2. That provision prohibits contribution claims against a person that has resolved its liability in the United States or state in administrative or judicially approved settlement. The settlement bar does not, by its terms, protect against cost recovery under 107A. For several reasons, we doubt this supposed loophole would discourage settlement. First, as stated above, defendant PRPs may trigger equitable apportionment by a 113 counterclaim, skipping. Second, the settlement bar continues to provide significant protection from contribution suits by PRPs that have inequitably reimbursed the cost incurred by another party. Third, settlement carries the inherent benefit of finally resolving liability to the United States. Atlantic Research was not improperly decided, and any argument premised on the assumption that it was is basically one that I believe the Court should not accept. Your Honors, have any questions for me?
No, not at this time, I don't think.
Would you address, I guess my question would be relative to the declaratory judgment for auto owners. Is that more properly presented to you or co-counsel?
That's co-counsel, yes, Mr. Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, I should add one last point. A key to understanding the 107 and 113 issue in this case is to understand that the terms of the consent order did not provide the settling parties, and I'm not talking about de minimis parties, the non-de minimis parties, with any release of CERCLA liability at all. The government reserved all of its rights to proceed against the settling parties under CERCLA, under any other applicable law. So there was no resolution of liability under CERCLA to the United States. The terms of the order are set out in our main brief. But it's absolutely clear there is no final settlement in that case of the government's rights under CERCLA, so there's no resolution. And that very point was picked up on by the NL Industries case in the Northern District of New York, where they had a consent order that was virtually the same as the consent order we have. The court ruled specifically that that kind of consent order is not a resolution of liability to the United States. Therefore, the contribution bar of CERCLA does not apply.
Let me ask you this question.
If
we find no Section 107 claim,
yes, ma'am,
and only a 113 claim, if no triggering event has occurred for the three-year statute of limitations under 113, can you even sue under CERCLA, the Section 113?
I believe...
You know, is it just a statute of limitations issue, or does your claim not even accrue? You know, so in other words, we find there's no 107 claim, only a 113.
Yes, ma'am.
If there's no triggering event that's occurred for the three-year statute of limitations under 113, can you still sue under 113?
The provisions are slightly different. One is the statute of limitations trigger, if that trigger doesn't apply, but the Rumpke case says, and the Fifth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit, we've cited the cases, say you look elsewhere in the statute, and you look to whether the action is a removal action or a remedial action, and if it's a removal action, you apply the statute of limitation as to removal actions. If it's remedial action, you apply the statute of limitations as to remedial actions. So there is a fallback if that doesn't apply.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Emhart?
Yes, Your Honors. I will first quickly address the IELA issues here on the appeal. The trustees have a claim under the Indiana Environmental Legal Action Statute, and we believe that the district court erred in granting summary judgment on the statute of limitations for that claim. Under Indiana law, the IELA has a 10-year limitation period that does not accrue until costs are paid. There's two cases decided after our case was filed, Flans versus Foster and Cooper Industries versus City of South Bend are the controlling cases. And then in the spring General Assembly session of the Indiana Legislature, a statute was passed that directly coincides and agrees with the Flans analysis done by the Indiana Supreme Court in 2008. And that is that there's a 10-year limitation period. The costs do not, it applies when costs are incurred, and there's no relation back to earlier times and costs incurred by others. It's a focus on the cost incurred in a 10-year period that runs from that date. And we believe that statute applies, and even if it weren't to apply, the law that existed is completely consistent with that statute. And I will reserve issues for the race judicata issues on rebuttal. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chambers?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. For the defendant appellees, the Bankerts, Cynthia Russell, and EnviroChem Corporation, Robert Chemers from Pretzel and Stauffer here in Chicago, with my associate Peter Sirigelis on the brief. I thought this was confusing preparing the briefs. I thought it was confusing preparing for the oral argument, but I am more confused now after hearing counsel address this court. This is a round peg in a square hole. Judge DiGiulio asked a question with respect to the 122G de minimis settlement trigger. We think it's clear. One of the triggers under 113G3 is the date of the administratively approved settlement under 122G. There were de minimis settlements here. What the plaintiffs are attempting to do is say that you have to splice the administrative orders on consent, where you have de minimis settlements and the premium response. The non-premium respondents and the premium respondents. No case has approved that. Judge Young in the district court rejected the argument because they came forward with no case in support of that position. They have no case in support of that position here. They are relying on pre-Atlantic Research cases
But the plain language of the statute of limitations in 113G3 refers only to de minimis settlements. Why should we read it to apply to actions against non-de minimis parties?
Well, you'd have to separate the premium respondents and the non-premium respondents who entered into the administrative order on consent in 1999 and 2002. No court has done that yet. The trigger is clearly 3 years from the date of that settlement, which would here bar these claims. But the plaintiffs say, We're not even parties to that agreement. So they're looking at the so-called gap or the open question Atlantic Research created. And I think Judge Williams, that goes to a question you asked Mr. Bernstein. In Atlantic Research, I think what the Supreme Court did, even in its own footnote 6, was recognize that if a party voluntarily cleaned up a site, as the plaintiff did in the, as Atlantic Research did, voluntarily cleaned up the site, not subject to a government order or consent decree, then it was entitled to maintain a 107 cost recovery action. What the Supreme Court said is there may be overlap between 107A and 113F. However, if you're a volunteer and not subject to a government decree or order, then you maintain a 107 action. They say we do not need to decide whether you can recover those costs, what they call the compelled costs of response, under 107A, 113F, or both. So you have that recognized in Atlantic Research. Then we heard Mr. Bernstein refer to the Aguirre case from the Third Circuit from last year, where the court basically said if you're a volunteer, then you can maintain a 107 action, but you can't maintain a 107 action and a 113 action because to do so would allow the PRP and the 107 claimant. There was a group of PRPs, one non-settling party, who would be able to get 100% of their costs from the non-settling defendant. The court said that was an inequitable, unjust result. Therefore, they were limited to a 113 contribution claim. Here, the district court correctly found that there was no entitlement to a cost recovery claim under 107 because the plaintiffs were not volunteers. Look at the history of the site, the EPA at this site. Soil testing back in the 1980s. In 1996, a unilateral administrative order. The plaintiffs were aware of that. They were aware of the cleanup efforts at that site for more than 10 years before that order was entered. 1999 administrative order on consent, which led to the funding of the engineering evaluation cost analysis. In 2001, was the enforcement action memorandum to implement the engineering evaluation, which then led to the 2002 administrative order on consent. They say that these were voluntarily entered into. Even the district court said they look at the first paragraph, or the first sentence of the orders, from 99 and 2002 and ignore the balance of the orders. There was nothing voluntary by the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs did not voluntarily clean up the site. The plaintiffs also tell the court in their briefs that they weren't in existence in 1996. The trust was created in 1999. That fact was irrelevant as the third parties are held accountable for the time running against their predecessors in interest. Also, they stand in the shoes of the PRPs. As fiduciaries under the trust, the plaintiff trustees are liable parties under CERCLA.
Well, let's go back to, because this CERCLA statute is very confusing, but doesn't it make the most sense to allow Section 107A claim to proceed, and then you can argue for apportionment and not 100% liability? That way, doesn't it ensure that everyone pays their fair share of the cost here?
That would be the correct analysis if the plaintiffs were volunteers. The plaintiffs were not volunteers.
Well, where does the voluntary versus compelled distinction come from with respect to 107 versus 113?
Cooper,
doesn't it make sense to allow costs incurred for cleanup to proceed under 107 and reimbursement costs to proceed under a 113 contribution claim?
The U.S. Supreme Court in the Cooper Industries versus Avial case recognized that if a party voluntarily cleaned up a site and had not been subject to a civil action, that party could only bring a cost recovery action under 107A. The Atlantic Research case had a similar result. A private party who voluntarily undertakes a cleanup could only bring a 107A cost recovery action. The court there in Atlantic Research discussed the interplay between 107 and 113. The position here and what the district court, we believe, correctly found on this record was that these plaintiffs did not voluntarily undertake a cleanup of Third Site. The third site in Zionsville, Indiana. If they did not voluntarily undertake that cleanup, then they have no 107A right of action for cost recovery. They're limited to a contribution claim, and the contribution claim was barred by 113G3. They say they're not in 113G3. They cite Rumke. They want the court to look to this court's dictum in the 1997 decision in Rumke of Indiana, which I think Mr. Emhart argued, where the court said the statute of limitations won't run if there's no trigger. They relied on pre-Atlantic Research cases such as Garrity, ITT, GenCorp versus Olin, where they the courts wrestled with the so-called gap in the statute of limitations under 113, that if there was no trigger, some courts said there's no statute of limitations. Others said it's 6 years from the date of removal. Others said it's 3 years. We don't think we have to go into that area because there was a de minimis settlement approved, administratively approved under with 122G factors to it, which would set forth the trigger under 113G3.
Well, does the contribution bar found in Section 113 here matter, given the Supreme Court's holding in Burlington Northern? Doesn't that case hold that apportionment under 107A is appropriate such that the defendants won't have to pay the full 100% of the cost under a joint and several liability theory?
If the party bringing the 107A cost recovery action is a volunteer. Because a volunteer would be entitled to recover back what the volunteer paid. And here, again, they're not volunteers. I don't think there was anything voluntary about what the plaintiff trustees did at Third Sight. The state law claims.
Counsel, before you get to that, isn't there a distinction between the de minimis and non-de minimis parties that ought to have some impact on the statute of limitations? Because for the de minimis parties, the amount of contribution was established. For the non-de minimis parties, that's rather speculative at that point because you don't know what the cleanup costs are. So wouldn't that dictate a different application of a statute of limitations period?
The only answer I can make to that, Your Honor, is no court has yet recognized that. That's what the plaintiffs are attempting to do here, we believe. They're trying to, in effect, splice the administrative orders on consent involving the premium respondents and the non-premium respondents. The premium respondents were the de minimis settlors, and they're out. So you have these two aspects, and no court has said you can divorce one from the other. You look at the overall settlement that led to the administrative order on consent, and if you have the 122G factor, which we believe is clearly present here, that's a trigger date for the three-year statute of limitations for contribution.
But if we go back to the plain language of the statute, 113G3, do we need case law when the plain language only refers to de minimis settlement? And why do we have to read it to apply to actions against non-de minimis parties?
I don't know.
Following up on what my colleague said, I'm just saying the plain language of the statute of limitations in 113G only refers to de minimis settlements, right? You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. So why should we read it to apply to actions against non-de minimis parties? Well, I suppose your answer is, well, there are no cases that have held otherwise.
Unfortunately, yeah. that would be my answer. That's almost a cop-out, and I wish I had something better to say. But even the district court said you can't separate the de minimis and the non-de minimis. And the plaintiffs offered no case in the district court, and we submit they've offered no case to this court. And if I may, Your Honors, I just briefly, I only have a few minutes left, but briefly address the state law claims. The plaintiffs have waived any argument that the claims for negligence and nuisance were improperly dismissed. They make no argument. They only talk about their claim under the ELA, the Environmental Law Action. We would submit to the court that that was properly dismissed by the district court. Also,
let me ask you this. Why would the 1996 order serve as the date of the order for the state ELA claim? Does that order serve as a basis for any of these recovery or contribution claims?
No. But it's part of the prior knowledge. The statute talks about that there's a discovery aspect. Under the Indiana law, the discovery rule would be when they knew or actually knew of the pollution. It's a question of law when the statute of limitations accrues. And the Indiana Supreme Court held that where there is some ascertainable damage has occurred, the statute runs. The ascertainable damage occurred as early as 1996 when they were ordered to clean up the site. And it was continuing through the orders that were entered in 99 and 2002. The ELA itself has no statute of limitations. The Indiana courts were confused as to whether they should apply a 6-year or a 10-year. One court said it didn't make a difference. Also, you can't bring an action under that statute prior to the ELA's effective date of February 28, 1998. This action was filed in April of 2008 and would have been barred. The statute that the Indiana General Assembly enacted effective July 1 of this year provides that it doesn't relate back to an action that was fully adjudicated involving 13-30-9-2, which is the Indiana ELA that we're talking about. So even if that statute had some application here, its own provision says it doesn't relate back to an action that's already been adjudicated, and it doesn't permit an amendment of an action that's already been filed or adjudicated. We would ask the court, for all of those reasons, to affirm the judgment of the district court. We'd also ask the court to deny the plaintiff's motion for certification of that singular issue involving the July 1, 2011 effective statute to the Indiana Supreme Court.
Counsel, let me ask, relative to the ELA claim, what if some pollution or hazardous or toxic waste were discovered 20 years after 1998? It's just simply beyond the statute of limitations and there's no remedy? I mean, is that essentially what you're arguing? The statute began to run in 1998? Any remedial action that was required 10 years thereafter is just beyond the statute of limitations? There's no remedy?
What I said was that no claim under the statute could begin to run prior to the effective date of the statute, which was what the Indiana Supreme Court said in Cooper Industries versus South Bend.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Again, I'd ask the court to affirm and to deny the motion for certification. The plaintiffs asked this court for to the Indiana Supreme Court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Yeager?
Hey, please, the court. I'm John Yeager on behalf of defendant and appellee and cross-appellant Auto Owners Insurance Company. I'm going to address some matters on the cross-appeal, and with the limited time, I want to focus on essentially two things. One is the aspect of the earlier declaratory judgment of 1990 and 1991 in the Rumpke versus Cummins case, and the second, the supplemental authority that deals with whether we have a proper cross appeal. Dealing first with Rumpke, as I prepare, I notice that there is a test, because what the plaintiffs are saying is the Rumpke case establishes that you should treat these as separate sites, because there the court didn't apply res judicata to a consent decree. But the difference there was that there was an actual separate operation at the Seymour site and at the Rumpke site, and some waste had been transported to the Rumpke site. And perhaps most importantly, I want to focus on the test that this court established or stated there, saying that the work is a part in kind, context, and time from the other site. And what I submit is that in this case, there isn't that ability to say that the two are apart in kind, context, and time. And besides, we're dealing not with an EPA site. In other words, our judgment on no coverage here isn't in terms of the EPA consent order, because at that time there had been a 1983 consent order that dealt with a surface cleanup, and then there was a lawsuit that was filed by the EPA. There were cross claims that were filed, and really the important things, I think, there's two parts. One, we've said that if you look at the plaintiff's complaint, you can see that they're really talking about an integral operation here. And the second is that the claims in the underlying case that were referred to went beyond just that surface cleanup and dealt with subsurface. They dealt with future claims. And so they expanded it to whatever may be found, and that was actually the language in one of the claims that was presented there. So that I submit that the Rumpke case, really, when you look at it in terms of saying, is third site and is the EnviroChem site a part in kind, context, and time, the answer here is no. And what I draw the court's attention to is the complaint in this case, paragraphs 1, 8, 15, and 18. One says third site was used for the temporary staging and storage of liquid hazardous substances used in a now-defunct recycling business known as Environmental Conservation and Chemical Corporation, commonly referred to as EnviroChem. That is an apart in kind context and time. Paragraph 8 refers to the bankers' involvement, said that they had ownership interests in EnviroChem and were involved in the operations of EnviroChem, including the disposal of hazardous substances at Third Site. That is an apart in kind context and time. Paragraph 15 refers to Third Site was, quote, used by the bankers as a staging and storage area for liquid hazardous substances, which were used in EnviroChem's operations. Again, not a part in kind context and time. And then paragraph 18 says, during the time that the liquids were being staged, stored, and released at Third Site, the bankers owned EnviroChem and were involved in its daily operations, including decisions to stage and store the hazardous substance at Third Site. Again, this isn't a part. So that I submit that the trial court erred in saying that there was ambiguity in the judgment when it refers to EnviroChem site activities, because whether you look at the plaintiff's complaint, which says that they're integral, or you look at the underlying claims that had been in that 1983 EPA suit with the cross claims, they clearly were not a part. They were an integral part of the operation, and the claims that are present today are simply ones that arise out of EnviroChem operations. The second thing I wanted to address was the whether we're here properly on a cross appeal. The supplemental authority was cited by the plaintiffs, the Marcatante versus City of Chicago case. Jake Kahn, you were on the panel, came there on the panel in that case. And then we cited as a response to that the Weisenkamp versus Unum case, which recognized the continuing validity of the conditional cross appeal case, the seminal case, the Council 31 case, which said that you can take a conditional cross appeal even if you would be satisfied with an affirmance, if you would be aggrieved by the, if you don't have an affirmance in the first case. And I submit we're in that status, that here we have an independent issue, so that one test I would submit is that if you granted the relief in both the appeal and the cross appeal, would the judgment look the same? If it is, then probably what you have is just an additional ground for an appeal, and you don't have a proper cross appeal. But in our case, what we would say is if you reverse as to the bankers and EnviroChem, then we want a different judgment. We want a judgment that there is no coverage as a result of the prior declaratory judgments. And so we have a proper cross appeal. And the further thing I would point out is that in preparation, I was looking for other information, but went to the website for the Seventh Circuit, and its practitioner's guide for cross appeals refers to a case called Dahl versus Brown, which has the site on that is 75 F3D 1200, which refers to a conditional alteration of the judgment. And there's an internal site to an earlier case, and to submit that's the situation we're in, where we want a conditional alteration of judgment. We, of course, are very happy if you will affirm as to no liability of the policy, putative policyholders and insureds, because then there is no basis to collect under the coverage. But if you don't, we submit that our cross appeal should be granted and the earlier denial of our motion for summary judgment be reversed. Any questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time?
7 minutes.
Your Honors, to address the res judicata arguments, the trustees believe that the cross appeal should be dismissed based on the authority of EOC versus City of Chicago, which we think appropriately looks at the U.S. Supreme Court's authority, Perez versus Ledesma and Partmore versus Paramount. And in those cases, it says a successful party cannot appeal from its own victory, and nor may a successful party appeal findings not necessary to support the ruling in the main appeal. And the res judicata ruling was merely a denial of a motion for summary judgment. It has nothing to do with statute of limitations in a CERCLA case or an IELA case, and for that reason, we don't think it's appropriately before the court. I will say that there are a doctrine of conditional cross appeals in the Seventh Circuit. The Weitzenkamp case cited by Mr. Yeager did not allow a cross appeal and really called into question the 31 council authority that they had used to say that. So now I just think that the issues are so different here, and they're not being adversely affected by a mere denial of a summary judgment motion on res judicata. If this case is reversed on CERCLA and ILA, we go back to Judge Young in the district court, and everyone is still free to argue whether or not res judicata applies. And for those reasons, we'd ask that the cross appeal be dismissed. If the appeal is considered, the res judicata appeal, it's important to look at the fact there were two orders, a default judgment against EnviroChem and its receiver and some other companies that worked there, and then a later agreed judgment involving the banker defendants and a couple of the companies that became settlors in a small way to the Third Site Trust Fund. With respect to the default judgment, the original complaint in 1984 did not include any allegations about policies in the 78, 79, and 79, 80 policy years. Those are not part of the 84 complaint, and the district court found that. So there's no final judgment about the first policies that are alleged in our case on the default judgment. With respect, and the default judgment has got to be looked at in terms of what is in the 84 auto owner's complaint. The agreed judgment does have a list that includes the 78, 79, 79, 80 policies, but again, it's a limited declaration that the parties agreed to. It's basically a consent agreement. It's really to be construed under contract law, and there are two things in that agreed judgment: claims made, where we designated plenty of undisputed evidence that there was no claim made about Third Site as of the time the parties entered into the agreed judgment, and that's one requirement of the language, and that the EPA expressly carved out and said EnviroChem would not include Third Site, and the evidence is undisputed in that regard. Second, there's language at the end of the agreed order, and I'll have to read it to you, which says, arising out of EnviroChem site activities or conditions which constitute release or otherwise of pollutants into the environment. And that, there's undisputed evidence from the affidavit of Ron Hutchins, who's the Environ engineer at the site, that the two remedies that EnviroChem, there is absolutely no mixing of pollutants in EnviroChem and Third Site. That EnviroChem was discovered, a remedy was created, an investigation undertaken, and that site is being cleaned up. Third Site is geographically distinct. We also designated several different drawings and depictions. It is to the south of EnviroChem, and the remedy being done for that is for the pollution emanating only from Third Site. So they are distinct, and that language in the agreed judgment supports finding that it does not apply to the Third Site case. And finally,
Counsel, could I ask, yes, would that also serve as a basis to preclude collateral estoppel or issue preclusion as opposed to claim preclusion as a basis for granting summary judgment?
When auto owners moved for summary judgment or moved to dismiss, they just used the term res judicata. And the court simply denied the motion for summary judgment on res judicata. And I would say that the parties are still free to try to look for issues here and there that might apply to issue preclusion as opposed to claim preclusion, but the motion simply was denied. So all those things go back to the district court. We think we'll be able to show with even other evidence that res judicata can't apply and that we should win, but that's something for the district court to hear later. Okay. And I'll let Mr. Bernstein address CERCLA.
How much time? You have 1 minute.
Two quick points, Your Honor. In addition to the Burlington Northern case on the apportionment issue, there's Judge Ginsburg's opinion in the Abiol case, which basically says there may well be a implied right to contribution under 107A itself, And in other words, not automatically joint and several liability. And then we go fast forward to Atlantic Research in footnote 8. The court leaves open explicitly whether or not there is a right of contribution under 107A. So 107A is not automatically joint and several, both for that reason and the Burlington Northern case Your Honor cited. Also, counsel has not correctly stated what the court found. The district court on pages 4 to 6 of its opinion starts out by saying the 1999 consent order had two separate parts, one regarding premium respondents and one regarding non-premium respondents, and spends two pages going through the facts and saying that they were completely different. The district judge understood the consent order, and he didn't rule against us because we were de minimis parties. He ruled against us because he misread the statute and didn't accept the plain language of the statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Martino. Our thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.